President Martina Steyn, as part of our South African History Open Day, we'll look at one of the most extraordinary presidents in history, Martina Steyn of the Orange Free State. Martina Steyn was a courageous and principled statesman, and he is the sixth and last president of the independent Orange Free State. President Martina Steyn is considered one of the finest examples of a Christian president, and he had one of the finest Christian constitutions any country has ever had. His integrity was widely recognized by all, including by his enemies, as of the highest standards. Martina Steyn was born at Rietfontein, Winburg, 2nd of October 1857. His father was Martinus Steyn and his mother Cecilia from the Wessels family. He first attended a farm school, and then he studied at the prestigious Grey College in Bloemfontein, which, amongst others, Hansie Cronje, the famous cricketer, studied at and is buried at. At the suggestion of James Buchanan, he continued his education at Leiden University in the Netherlands. He completed his legal training in England. So, well-travelled, well-educated man. He was admitted to the bar in London in 1882, and then he returned to Orange Free State and soon had a flourishing legal practice in Bloemfontein. This, by the way, is the highest court in the land, our Supreme Court in Bloemfontein. Bear in mind, South Africa has three capitals in accordance with Reformation principles, separation of executive, legislative and judicial. The executive capital is Pretoria, where Union Buildings and the President is. The legislative capital is Cape Town with Parliament, but the judicial capital of South Africa is Bloemfontein. That's where our Supreme Court is. So, interesting that we've geographically separated 1,400 kilometres away our capitals, which statists hate. They want everything centralised. On the 10th of March 1887, he married Rachel Isabella Fraser, and in 1889 he was appointed State Attorney of the Orange Free State. In 1892 he became a judge of the High Court in Orange Free State. When the State President F.W. Rietz resigned in 1895, Judge Steyn was recommended as a successor. The other candidate, J.G. Fraser, opposed close cooperation with the South African Republic, what we call the Transvaal, while Steyn strongly supported close ties and cooperation with the ZAR, or Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek. And in fact, you can see this is some of the honours that you'll see in the Kruger House, showing President Kruger and Martina Steyn as the two allies. The Jameson Raid, which was attempting to violently seize control of Transvaal, swayed public opinion overwhelmingly in favour of Judge Martina Steyn, and he was elected by a landslide and sworn in as President of the Orange Free State, 4th of March 1896. At this stage, he was only 39 years old, but a strong sense of duty, Christian integrity and wisdom was way past his years. You can see in the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein, his desk, his chair, some of his pictures on the wall, some of his legal books in the rotating type of bookshelf, and you get the impression of a focused man. This is a contemporary picture of or map of South Africa at that time. Notice here the Cape Colony, you've got Natal, Zululand, Orange Free State, Basutoland, Transvaal, and here you've got the British Protectorate of Bechuanaland, and then Matabeleland, part of what became Rhodesia and then Zimbabwe, and you've got at this stage Southwest Africa is German Southwest Africa. As the newly elected President of Orange Free State, Martina Steyn had to deal with the intrigues of Sir Alfred Milner, the new British High Commissioner. Milner was an ardent imperialist who was involved in schemes to undermine the independence of the Southern Republic and seize control of the goldfields. Well, their people already own the goldfields, but they want to control a country that controlled the goldfields as well. President Steyn considered the British imperial policy as a clear and present danger to the independence and freedom of the Orange Free State. And this is Chamberlain, the British colonial secretary who was the power behind Milner and gave him his orders, basically, along with those of the Rothschilds, of course. So, Martina Steyn hosted a conference in Bloemfontein, March 1897, attended by President Paul Kruger. And here's some of the people gathered together there. And Martina Steyn is on the far left. This looks like Koos de la Rey over here, and President Paul Kruger. Not sure who that was. Stein proposed that they should extend the political line to 1889 by adding a clause that the Boer republics would consult with each other on all matters that could lead to war with Great Britain. The biggest possible foreign affairs concern was war with Great Britain, which they'd already had before in the First Anglo-Boer War of 1880 to 81. President Stein did attempt to persuade the Transvaal government to become more flexible to accommodate the aspirations of the Oaklander franchise and the dynamite monopoly. All pretexts have been used by the British imperial government to initiate a war. A series of crises and diplomatic manoeuvring came to a head when the High Commissioner Alfred Milner broke off talks with President Kruger concerning the Oaklander franchise. President Stein had initiated the Bloemfontein Conference of 31 May to 5 June 1899. When Milner walked out of the negotiation, war became imminent. Now, what I could add at this point is that according to Stephen Mitford Goodson, who is a biographer of Jan Smuts, who had ingratiated himself into the Transvaal and become the Attorney General of Transvaal, and who wrote the on his own authority the ultimatum to Britain which catapulted them into war, was an agent of the British before, during and after the Anglo-Boer War. That's interesting. Jan Smuts was a Cambridge law student who, and Cambridge is where the British Special Secret Services have tended to do their recruiting. When Smuts came back to South Africa, he pledged himself to the policies of Cecil Rhodes, and Cecil Rhodes at that stage was the Prime Minister of the Cape. And then he went up immediately and became Attorney General of the Transvaal and did everything he could to bring the Transvaal into war. But that's behind the scenes. Smuts was doubtless working for the other side throughout the war, never did anything that hurt the British interest, and was the one who pulled them to the negotiation table at Vereeniging to end the war when they needed it. But Martina Stein wouldn't have known about that at the time. Just introducing somebody else's inputs there. On the 27th of September 1899, Stein presented to the Free State Volksraad a sober report, which concluded that he had rather lose the independence of the Orange Free State with honour than fail to stand by the Transvaal in the hour of need. President Stein declared that by declaring war, politicians admit that they have failed diplomatically. And by declaring war, politicians effectively hand over control to the military. Now this is how principled he was. We've declared war. That means we've failed. We politicians have failed. That means the military are now in control. And having declared war, he would now join the commandos and fight alongside the burghers. And he would not use his political powers to interfere in the military strategies of the generals. And that's what he did. He fought throughout the war as one of the commandos. President Stein became one of the bitter enders, literally, fought to the bitter end, who courageously fought to the very end of the ruinous Anglo-Boer War. He was in the field under General Christian de Wet, who said he has never interfered with. President never pulled rank, never interfered, he followed orders. So basically he said, if you declare war as a politician, you've admitted you failed, and you can't send other men and sons and fathers to war without going to war yourself. And if you do, you must follow the generals, because now it's a military thing. We only get to take a role again when it comes to negotiations for peace. So, and now, how interesting, imagine today if our cursed politicians who declare war and send people off to war went to war and didn't interfere with the generals while they were at war. Wouldn't that be refreshing? President Stein was frequently seen at the front lines encouraging his burghers with his steadfast example and his resilience and courage. After the catastrophic surrender of General Piet Cronje, who was definitely not the right person for the job, he had over 4,000 Boers, and he was static, and he didn't move at Paardenberg, and he got himself surrounded, and he didn't break out, and he was really a catastrophic choice as a general, and Piet Cronje caused the Boers their biggest defeat they suffered in the whole war. Stein sought to rally the demoralized citizens or burghers to make a determined stand. However, at the battles of Poplar Grove and Abraham's Kraal, they failed to stop the British advance on Bloemfontein. So on the 13th of March 1900, Lord Roberts, head of the British forces, entered Bloemfontein with the British forces. Stein's government evacuated Bloemfontein just the day before. At Kroonstad, Stein convened a joint council of war where President Kruger, and General Piet Joubert, head of the Transvaal forces, were also present. There they decided to abandon their wagons, to deploy mounted commandos, transform the more static conventional war into mobile guerrilla warfare operations, which General James Barry Herzog played a key role in advocating, but we'll get to that later. Interesting, here's one of the few colorized versions of a picture at the time, and you can see General Joubert in the center out in the field with his forces. Considering General Joubert played a key role in the First Anglo-Boer War, for him to still be head of the military in the Second Anglo-Boer War, maybe they had someone who hadn't moved up with the times, he hadn't kept up with tactics, and he was fighting a fairly unimaginative war of siege, which unfortunately was counterproductive. So the British besieged Bethlehem on the 7th of July, denying the Orange Free State government its last seat of power. From this time on, President Steiner's executive council remained in the field fighting under command of General Christian de Wet. On numerous occasions, President Steiner intervened when the Transvaal sought to open up peace negotiations with the British. Being a judge, trained in Britain, fully bilingual, he was an ideal choice. When the Transvaalers were talking about surrender, President Steyn and General de Wet remained adamant that only conditions for negotiations had to be independence and freedom for the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. President Steyn accompanied General de Wet on operations into the Cape Colony to disrupt the supply lines of the British forces who were occupying Transvaal and the Free State at that time. And there were some extraordinary events where they managed to take entire British columns, take the guns, the cannons, take their supplies with very imaginative mobile warfare. When his term of office expired, he insisted that they had to hold fresh presidential elections, even though they were in the middle of a war and the people were scattered, which was very unpractical but principled. At Doornburg, the oath of office was administered and President Steyn was sworn in a second time for a second term of office. President Steyn then drafted the replies of the Orange Free State to the British authorities in very well-reasoned legal terminology, which greatly encouraged the ongoing resistance of the burghers against the illegal war. President Steyn delivered an answer to General Roberts's annexation of the Orange Free State, declaring that the Republic of the Orange Free State still existed and the annexation was illegal in terms of international law, aside from anything else. There's an interesting monument at the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein. You see De Bitter Einde, and this really depicts the spirit of someone like Martina Steyn. Hoss is worn and haggard, he's dressed in rags, but he's still fighting. He's lost just about everything, but they still carried on to the very end. On the 7th of August 1901, in response to Lord Kitchener's scorched earth and concentration camp policies, President Steyn protested the inadmissible methods of barbarous warfare which were targeting citizens against the Hague Conventions and the Geneva Convention, which Britain had just signed just a year before the war began, dynamiting 30,000 farmsteads, poisoning wells, wiping out hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of livestock, destroying grain stocks, destroying people's livelihoods, putting the women to concentration camps where they died like flies. In March 1902, President Steyn joined the commando of General de Wet at Doringspruit to receive eye surgery. Acting President Scott Berger informed him of the negotiations taking place at Krugersdorp. He would have been acting President of Transvaal or South African Republic. 31 May 1902, Kitchener was most impressed by President Steyn and declared of him that he was head and shoulders above all the others, certainly intellectually. When everyone else was ready to sign the surrender, de Wet and Steyn demanded self-government and reparations. Notice, the Transvaalers were ready for peace long before the Free State. You sometimes get the impression that the Transvaalers were tough and the Free Staters were not as much because they didn't go as far on the Great Trek, but actually the Free Staters proved to be the most intransigent, principled, bitter ender, fight to the end, and both their General de Wet and their President Steyn were the most tenacious enemies the British had. Steyn was in Kroonstad for medical attention when the Treaty of Vereeniging was signed 31 May 1902, and as he stated, he never would have signed it anyway. In June, Steyn and his wife left for Europe for medical attention, and when he returned to South Africa, he campaigned for self-government, served as one of the Orange Free State delegates at the National Convention, and it's the National Convention that led to the Union of South Africa. It was President Steyn's initiative that led to the first act of the Union of South Africa being the minting of the half-cent coins, with two sparrows in them, to remind us that God cares for the very least. And I've actually got one of these coins here. You can pass it around. You can see this was a half-cent piece. So Jesus said, are not two sparrows sold for a single coin, a single penny, and yet your Father in heaven cares for such as these. God cares for the really. So the first act of the union was the minting of the half-cent coin. This in fact is even less. This is a farthing, which is a quarter of a cent. And 1961, it's still a half-cent piece. See the two sparrows. And this was the half-cent piece right up, and I remember using the one-cent piece. And you may think, well, what could you get for 1 cent? Well, you could get four chappies for 1 cent. So when I was a child, for example, 1 cent was still, you know, it was quite... It's only in the Mandela years that the 1 cent fell out of use because our currency basically was so debased that now our lowest denomination is a 10 cent. But this, for 100 years, has been a reality in South African life. Interesting, just look at some other coins. You notice there's always been a symbol of Cape Town, the lady with the anchor and the sea. That's a symbol of Cape Town since the 1600s already. Notice you'll sometimes get King George on the cover. On the one side you'll get Ossewaard, sometimes Jan van Riebeck. Sometimes you've got, in this case, this would have been King George V, and King George VI there, Queen Elizabeth, the Dromedaris, the ship on which Jan van Riebeck came, and of course the Springbok. So we've had different things on the one side, and of course the, on the other side you often got this the sparrows. But notice on the 1 rand coin, it's been very standard to have the Springbok. Now this is what I grew up with. Here I've got, and you can pass this one around. This is the 1 rand coin, which notice it's got not just the Springbok, but Soli Deo Gloria, the fifth sola of the Reformation, solely for the glory of God. And that's still on our new 1 rand coins. I mean, they're a lot smaller now, but our coins have diminished in size and in value, but nevertheless, it's still got Soli Deo Gloria on it. Mbeki took Soli Deo Gloria off for a while and put it on the, wrote it around the edge, which nobody could really read. And there was a lot of protest, which we led, and they had to put the Soli Deo Gloria back on the 1 rand coin in the Mbeki years. You've got to watch out. These things are important. And in America, they've got In God We Trust on their notes. We have Soli Deo Gloria on a coin and the two sparrows on the 1 cent coin for a long time. You can see sometimes... You've seen, like, this is the last of the South African Republic coins made. This is effectively £1. And see, 1898. Eindrach Mark Mach. Unity of strength. So that was the last of the coins of the Transvaal Republic. This is what I grew up with. The 1 cent coin with the sparrows. The flamingo on the 5 cent coins. The Wildebeest on the 2 cent coins. Most people don't know what a 2 cent coin is these days, but we used to be able to buy a lot of things with 2 cents. And of course the 1 rand coin, that was really serious stuff. You may think, what could you buy for a rand? When I was growing up, well, you could get a cinema ticket for 20 cents. You could get a Coca-Cola in the cinemas for 4 cents. You could get popcorn for 4 cents. Remember when it went up to 5. Chips were 3 cents. I remember when they were 2.5 cents when they moved up to 3 cents. When chip packet went up to 5 cents, I thought, this is terrible. I can never afford chips again. And I could get model aircraft for 45 cents, you know, Spitfires, Messerschmitts, and so on, that you could put together and glue and then paint and so on. So a lot of money that you could do with just 1 rand. And this is how it developed into more recently. Just looking at some old money. a 1 rand note was, you know, a lot of money there, and 2 rands as well. The highest denomination was the 10 rand. I remember when it went up to the 20, that seemed extreme. I mean, how seldom did I ever have a 20 rand note? These days, you treat that like it's almost nothing. Now, our good friends, Stephen Mitford Goodson, he was director of Southern Reserve Bank for 9 years. He said, our currency today is 1/500th what it was back in 1980. So what we could buy for 1 rand in 1980, you've got to pay 500 rand for now. So that's, and then, as Stephen Mitford Goodson said, got several of his books here on inside Southern Reserve Banks on, where he says, money does, prices don't go up. Money gets debased. When you say the price has gone up, you're actually missing the point. Said, actually, prices don't change. It's the money that gets debased. So, for example, 2,000 years ago in Rome, to get a toga, a leather belt, leather sandals would have cost 1 gold coin, and it still does. To get a suit, belt, tie, shoes, going to cost you the equivalent of 1 gold coin. So when you say the price have gone up, it's like speaking about the sun rising and setting. You're not actually being as accurate. They've debased the currency, and inflation is a hidden tax. You need an economist to remind you that inflation is a hidden tax. To think that the first act of the union was a half-cent coin with 2 sparrows on it. You could buy a lot for that half-cent coin. President Steyn, General Christian de Wet, and Reverend J.D. Kestell were considered the soul of the Boer struggle for freedom and independence. Reverend Kestell was the chaplain of Orange Free State Forces. Their reformed faith was the cornerstone of their policy. Kestell wrote through shot and flame. President Steyn was considered to be the first best choice for Prime Minister of South Africa when the new union came about in 1910. But for health reasons, he could not accept, and so that honour fell to General Louis Botha. And interestingly, they had Anderlecht Mark Mark, Unity is Strength, on the coin for 1910 union. I was born 1960, so this is 1960, on the 50th anniversary of that. This being a 5 shilling. Notice again, the cape, the woman with the anchor, Natal, the wildebeest, Orange Free State, orange tree, and Transvaal, the Osama, ox wagon. When the First World War erupted in 1914, President Steyn and Generals de Wet and Delarey were adamantly against the new nation of South Africa attacking German Southwest Africa. Notice the kind of propaganda. The empire needs men, and here are the young lions. The overseas states answer the call, and these are meant to represent Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. The young lions are meant to come to the support of the big line. Not that the empire had been attacked, not that the First World War had anything to do with Britain anyway, not that it had anything to do with us. But as martial law was declared and men were called up from all over the country, President Steyn, Generals Delarey and de Wet opposed this, believing it was dishonourable to fight for their previous enemies of the Boers, the men who had been shooting their prisoners of war and killing the women and children just 12 years before. And why should they be fighting against their faithful friends that support them during the Anglo-Boer War? After all the Boers were using the Mauser 7.7, the finest rifle at that time without a shadow of a doubt. And while the British believed it was impossible to hit a target at further than 800 metres, the Boers were routinely at 1,200 metres with these rifles, and sometimes up to a mile, 1,600 metres. So the Boer marksmanship was just extraordinary, helped, of course, by excellent rifles. The Commandant General of the Union Defence Force, General Christian Frederick Beyers, resigned as commissioner in protest, 15th of September 1914, stating, "It is sad that this war is being waged against the Germans. We have forgiven, but we have not forgotten all the barbarities committed in our own country by the British during the South African War." General Maritz also opposed South Africa's involvement in what they saw as Britain's war, to which South Africa should remain neutral. General Delarey was shot by the police accidentally, they said, at a roadblock. They said they mistook him, the most famous man in the country, for a bank robber. Highly unlikely. 12,000 rebels gathered at Magaliesburg to resist with force the government's determination to propel South Africa into the war. During the Battle of Doornburg, De Wet's son, Donnie, and several others of the rebels were killed. De Wet himself was captured at Waterbury, 30th of November 1914, imprisoned in the Johannesburg fort. He was found guilty of high treason and sentenced to 6 years imprisonment. Well, if he's guilty of high treason, it would have been more serious than that. But the sentence showed that, I mean, how can they call it high treason? He doesn't want to fight for his former enemies 12 years later. Many of the rebels were sentenced to terms of imprisonment from 6 to 7 years with heavy fines. There's a picture of some of the rebels riding on commando to oppose the government's attempt to propel South Africa into Britain's war. When Prime Minister Botha supported the British war policy and declared war on Germany, President Steyn resigned from the South African party in protest, spoke out against the imprisonment of General de Wet for opposing the war. Here's Louis Botha and Jan Smuts dressed in British army uniforms. That's how far they had gone and why they were considered Volksfreiers or traitors by most of their generation and for generations to come. I still know people who would consider Louis Botha and Jan Smuts as complete traitors. Martina Steyn had been a co-founder of the South Africa Party. However, when the South Africa Party supported war with Germany, he left in protest, and with General James Barry Hertzog, General Christian de Wet, they founded the National Party. The National Party started in 1914 specifically in opposition to dragging South Africa into a foreign war. Martina Steyn was the most prominent advocate for the establishment of the National Women's Memorial, which was unveiled in Bloemfontein 16 December 1913. This is how it looked then. Just look at all the trees around now. Look how it was when they planted. Desolate. This is, of course, a sign of what Christians should always do. Plant trees. As Martin Luther said, if he knew that Jesus was coming back tomorrow, he'd plant an apple tree today. The whole idea of work for the future. Look at this. You can see all the people gathering there for the establishment of this monument with their umbrellas. It's got to have been really hot. There's no trees, no shade at that stage. And you get a feel of how open everything was and how little shade there was at the beginning of this monument and memorial. Unveiling of the memorial. To the memory of our heroines and beloved children, your will be done.
Like, what if someone was the turning point and said that this could be something similar?
Okay, well, what is it depicting? First of all, the Abraham Lincoln monument is a temple, and he is sitting on an imperial throne. An imperial throne. America didn't have imperial thrones.
Just by size.
Size? Oh, this is very small compared. I can look at the Abraham Lincoln Memorial just now, if you like, and we can compare and see what you think. But thank you for bringing it up. I'll pull up the Abraham Lincolns just now. So this is in the memory of our heroines and beloved children. And it's modeled on a picture that was taken by Emily Hobhouse of two women. And this mother's got an obviously dead or dying baby in her hand. And this, at this stage when they built it, they knew of 26,370 women and children who died in the concentration camps. Now, through better research, they know it was over 32,000. They've got the names, dates, and places of 32,000 women and children who died in the British concentration camps on the walls there. So, on the one side, they've got the 5,600 names on a wall of the Boer men who died. Killed in action, shot as prisoners of war, died of wounds, or died of disease, specified, 5,600. On the other side, 32,000 women and children. In what wars do 6 times more women and children die than the men? That alone is quite a damning indictment. Emily Hobhouse, her remains are buried in this monument too. Interesting, the English woman, who was the advocate, for freedom, folk, and fatherland. President Steyn died of a heart attack while addressing a meeting in Bloemfontein, November 1916. He was only 58 years old. He's buried at the Women's Memorial at the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein. Look, a few years later, you can see a whole lot more trees that have grown up. And you can see later a lot more. Martinus Stain and his wife Rachel buried at the Woman's Monument. So interesting, there are three men buried at the Woman's Monument as well. So the War Museum of the Boer Republic's National Woman's Monument, the Orange Free State flag flies. Offskate, departure, showing a man riding off to commander as his wife holds the baby and stays behind. He's got his Mauser 7.7 rifle on his back, and in many cases, the last time they saw one of them. So, at the Woman's Monument Memorial, it's a memorial to remember those who have died, a lot of people. You can see on the way they've got panels commemorating people of different concentration camps. The Bitterende Monument, notice how many trees have sprung up. And again, you get a bit of detail on this Bitterende under the harsh sun. And then the Dibanelinge, the exiles. Many people were exiled to Ceylon, to St. Helena, all over the place, far away, as far as Portugal and so on. And so here is the Boer War Memorial for the men. This is at the Women's Monument at the Anglo-Boer War Museum. So it's from 1819 to 1902. And it's got the Mausers, it's got the names of those killed in action, specifying, and we will not forget them. And these are the commanders. And at the back, they've got those who died of disease or of wounds following. Prison Stain stands out as one of the finest examples of a principled Christian statesman, a patriot, and a courageous campaigner for freedom. I would rather lose the independence of the Free State with honor than retain it with dishonor, he said. This, by the way, is a monument in the Netherlands for Martinus Stain. So I've written an article in Joach Tijdschrift on this, and that's also a chapter in Die Skizze and Sketches from South African History. Prison Martinus Stain, the Orange Free State. We'll get to some of the other heroes and heroines in later presentations. Any questions, any comments on Martinus Stain?
It's interesting that South African currencies, international abbreviation, ZAR, which yes. Speaks of the Transvaal Republic.
Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic, yes. Yeah. Sure. I should draw attention to Stephen Mitford Goodson's book, The Genocide of the Boers, well illustrated. This by the previous director of Southern Reserve Bank, who committed major thought crimes by exposing what they were doing in the Reserve Bank and the scandals involved in it and the entire banking industry. And he got involved in history as a result. And he has got in this book, which we have in the shop, the hampers sent to the British soldiers for Christmas 1901 by the three top Rothschilds, main bankers in the world. And they were the only names on this Christmas card with the hampers, thanking all the British, Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, and other soldiers who were involved. And this hamper was very generous. It had everything from tobacco, cigarettes, pipe, soap, salt, sugar, sweets, cakes, pies, you name it. There's a whole lot of interesting and good things in there. And interesting, since when do bankers send hampers to soldiers fighting in a war? But it was for the Rothschilds' purposes. They wanted to genocide the Boers. The Boers had unfortunately tricked their wagons and built their farms over the greatest gold reserves and diamond reserves in the world. And the Rothschilds, who ran the Bank of England and a lot more, determined to genocide the Boers. This was an attempt to genocide them, as is documented by Emily Hobhouse, who we'll look at later. Boer women and children were dying, an average of 250 per thousand, sometimes up to 380 per thousand per year. That means in 4 years there wouldn't be one survivor. A quarter death toll per year. I mean, can you imagine? That is a worse death toll percentage-wise than any prison camp or concentration camp of the Second World War. And the British couldn't say, well, gee, you know, we were being bombed by 1,000 bomber raids and blockaded by our navy, so we couldn't get enough food to the people. They controlled the seas, and there was no aerial bombardment. And yet, the British camps were deliberately, and it was deliberate, it was proven by Emily Hobbes, they were deliberately starving them out. If it hadn't been for the concentration camps then, the Boers, the Afrikaners and their descendants would be the majority tribe in this country, larger than the Zulus and Xhosa combined. Wiping out a people's women and children at that critical stage when the average Boer woman was having 12 children. After all, Gesine Kruger had 16 children. So wiping out the women and children at that critical stage was so crippling to the development of South Africans that the Boers were destined to become a minority in their own country as a result of that planned genocide. And this genocide is the correct word. It was the planned destruction of a people. They destroyed 30,000 farms, dynamited their wells, poisoned their wells, dynamited their homes, absolutely destroyed everything, killed all their livestock, wiped out everything. And the fact that they didn't succeed in killing all the Boers is only thanks to people like Emily Hobhouse, who, and of course the men who fought in the field. But the disaster of that to our country, it still affects us to this day. This is vastly worse than what was done in the American War of Independence or anything else like that. The atrocities directed towards women and children in the Anglo-Boer War is a major crime, and I don't think Stephen Goodson's overstated the case by putting the word genocide in the title of this book. So any other comments or questions? Let me, to answer the question that we've been challenged about, bring up a comparison then with our dear...
Well, not specifically that point, but just in the sense that...
No, it's a good question. So what I'm looking for now is Lincoln. Will it be under A for Abraham, or will it be under L for Lincoln? Probably L for Lincoln. I can't always remember where I filed everything. Oops. The Lincoln... I did, that's true. But, here we go. Okay. So, we've got... Okay, let's jump past that. There we go. Here we get to... Abraham Lincoln. So... this is one colossal, look at the size of the people here, this temple, this is a temple. In this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever. Notice this imperial throne, it's a fascist Roman imperial throne. These are the fascist symbols that would have been on every Mussolini fascist Italian aircraft in the 1930s when they built this. This is at the height of fascism in Europe and communism, statism, Lincoln worship, Lenin worship in the Soviet Union, and of course Lincoln worship in America. This is pretty... there's lots of those statues and monuments, but you cannot compare almost any other kind of monument with it. Okay, just take how completely central this is. As you go into Washington, D.C., boy, is this pretty prominent and central. And any kind of anti-war, anti-American, pro-communist march or something, Lincoln Memorial is pretty key. This is like a major venue for you to yeah. And of course I don't particularly like this obelisk, which comes from Egypt. It's an Egyptian symbol, so I think it was a mistake to put that into the woman's monument, that specific thing, but the intention was different. Interestingly enough, this is the Communist Party USA 1936 or so. There's Lenin, there's Stalin. Stalin's still alive at that stage. And there's Lincoln. He is the patron saint of the Communist Party USA, to this day, of course. And notice, friendship of the people's USA and the USSR, and so on and so forth, unity, blah, blah, blah. This was while Stalin was dictator of the Soviet Union, wiping out tens of millions of his people in decolonization. And if you go to Cuba, you'll find they've got the Abraham Lincoln Boulevard, they've got the Abraham Lincoln High School and so on. I've asked Cubans, how can you name things after capitalists like Lincoln? No, he wasn't a capitalist. He's a comrade. He's one of us. Well, interesting enough, there's books out there like Lincoln and Marx. Marx and Lincoln were friends and correspondents. And I've got the book Lincoln's Marxists, showing that virtually the entire upper echelon of the Republican Party and of the Union forces were Marxists. There were 48ers. Karl Marx wrote the Marxist Manifesto in 1848, and you had the... they all failed, every capital of Europe, 1848. Many got killed, guillotined, hung, shot, whatever. And a whole lot of the other 48ers fled to America, and they formed the Republican Party, which is why the Republican Party to this day is a red tie. Now, you may often wonder, why have the conservatives got the red tie and the commies, liberal socialists, got the blue tie? Well, it wasn't that way 100 and something years ago. And so the Republicans were called the Red Republicans back in the time of the Civil War. And Lincoln's number one fan and supporter and PR campaign advocate overseas for his war was Karl Marx. And Karl Marx loved what Lincoln did. There's a book out, I haven't got hold of it yet, of Lincoln and Lenin. But Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln corresponded with one another. And in fact, the Lincoln's Marxists, to come back to this, the people who did most of the atrocities against the South were 48ers. They were European communists in the Union forces, in blue, who saw the Southerners as bourgeois landowners, so on, who need to be murdered. And so that's why the atrocities done by these Yankee war criminals was never punished by Lincoln. He appointed 48ers all over the place. The Republican Party was riddled with communists in the 1860s. And that's why they waged a genocidal war against their southern neighbors, because this was Marxism, centralization. And the fact that today a person like Lincoln is lifted up as an idol or a hero of the country, just absolutely bizarre. Yeah. And to put him together with George Washington, you couldn't find two more opposite people. And by the way, why was Abraham Lincoln called Honest Abe? For the same reason as Small Paul is called Small Paul, because he's so tall, or a Little John in Robin Hood, because he's so big. Honest Abe was known as a liar. He was a criminal. He was a complete infidel. He'd never attended church. He is the first person not baptized to be in the White House. He was a man who was of no religion. He attended no church. He was, back in the 1860s, that was a scandal. And, yeah, at any rate, I think he's a real and complete criminal. Yes.
Stalin, Lenin, and Marx all were very much influenced by Darwin's writing.
Very much.
Abraham Lincoln?
Oh, yes, no, he would have accepted Darwinian evolution. Oh, yes, no. No, he was a secular humanist. He's been baptized as a Christian by people since, but, you know, because he entered the pantheon of America's ex-presidents, and of course being assassinated makes you a saint as well. So he's been entered into serious hagiography now. They've turned him into a saint. But Lincoln is to the United States of America what Mandela is to South Africa, what Mao is to this old Chinese Communist Party, Lenin to the Soviet Union, and Churchill to Britain. I mean, an idol. Completely distorted out of all reality from what they really were. They're now mythological figures. And as Christians, we don't want idols, and we don't... So, yes, I think the way Lincoln's been made an idol, I don't think you can compare the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein with a Lincoln memorial, because of the fact that we don't have women's mind. Even that, it's not about an individual. There's no person there. It's speaking about a whole group of people who were killed. It's in memory of them. It's not lifting up somebody to an idol mythological status. In fact, if you ask a person who's buried at a woman's monument in Bloemfontein, most wouldn't be able to answer you. I mean, some of us have been there know Emily Hobhouse's interesting chaplain Kestrel, Christian De Wet, so there's a few men there, three men, Martina Steyn, Rachel Steyn. So there's two women and three men buried at the monument itself, but it's in memory of the tens of thousands who had no graves. So no, I don't think it's the same, but of course there's the danger that people can make an idol of anything if you're not careful. So, the Lord made sure that the Ark of the Covenant disappeared. And at one point, they were ordered to take the bronze serpent on a stake, which Moses had been ordered to make numbers in the Bible during the plague of snakes, and destroy it. Because there's a danger that we could make idols of things. So if we've got to build a monument, it should be for historical purposes, not for worship purposes. And the Reformed confessions have said there are three uses for art. Two are permissible, one is impermissible. So art is permissible for education and for decoration, but art is never acceptable for devotion. You cannot use art for worship. So a church that's got a picture, so-called, or icon of Jesus. I've been to churches that have got some pictures of some Californian hippie in a white coat and sandals, which they presume is Jesus, I presume, because it's got some holes in his hands and so on. And that's behind the pulpit. And to preach in a situation like that is just so distressing, because that's obviously idolatry. I mean, people are singing hymns looking towards this artistic depiction, not even a good one. At least the Coptic Orthodox churches have honoring type of style of art, although I wouldn't tolerate that either. But whether you've got a statue of Jesus or Mary or a crucifix in a Catholic church, an icon in an Orthodox church, or some bad, poor, tasteless art in a Pentecostal church, devotional art is wrong. It breaks the second command. That's idolatry, so we should have nothing to do with it. But it's not just in church. The state also lifts their own. Have you ever thought how statism is a false religion? So, okay, we have God, who we worship. Who does the state worship? Well, the state, the party, the chairman, the president, the king, whoever it is. So we have communion. What do they have? Well, they also, you know, we've got saints, if you remember. They've got the people who died in the wars. They've blood sacrifice. I mean, we've got the Lord's table. What do they have? Abortion. Abortion's their blood sacrifice. And you could go through a whole lot of things. So we've got worship services. They've got pornography and Hollywood and all this. There's so much between a statist false religion and the true faith. Everything Satan does is a bad copy, imitation. Statism is making an idol of the state. And so that's why we should never do it. Now, insofar as I think it's possible for some South Africans to make an idol of previous heroes, martyrs, so on, as Christians we should resist, warn against, and reject. And if it's becoming a real idol, we must oppose it. Like Mandela worship, Mandela Day, 18 July. What are you doing for your 67 minutes for Mandela? And the way they carry on and on about it, it's pretty idolatrous. It's like they're trying to start a new religion. A day, actions, things like this. So we've got to say, no, thank you, we're not going to do that. Not for any political or religious or historical leader. We worship God alone. So as Christians, we should oppose any idolatry. I think a person could make an idol even of good things, such as we could make an idol out of our church denomination or building or something like that, and that would be wrong too. There's nothing that we can't make an idol of. I think John Calvin said, the human being is an idol factory.